Good afternoon. I'd like to call this meeting of the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee to order. The time is now 1:32 p.m. We are in Belt's Room 105 at the Thomas Stewart Building in the nation's most beautiful capital city of Juneau, Alaska. Today is Monday, April 7th, 2025. Members present are Senator Gray Jackson, Senator Merrick, Senator Dunbar, Senator Yunt, and myself, Senator Bjorkman. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. Welcome, everyone, to Senate Labor and Commerce. I'd like to extend an especially warm Senate Labor and Commerce welcome to our recording secretary, Carrie Tupo, and our LAO moderator, Marne Provost. We have two bills on our agenda today. We're changing the order of business this afternoon to accommodate the schedule of other legislators and their also important work. First up, we will have Senate Bill 83, telehealth reimbursement rates. Following that, we'll have Senate Bill 21, AK Work and Save Program, Retirement Savings Board. First, we'll take up Senate Bill 83. This is our first hearing on this bill. Today, it is my intention to have a presentation of the bill, go through the sectional summary, and take invited testimony. Today, we have the bill sponsor, the Honorable Senator Matt Clayman, and his staff, Serena Hackemiller. Thank you for joining us. Welcome back to Senate Labor and Commerce. Please state your name for the record and begin your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee. For the record, my name is Matt Clayman. I'm the Senate Senator from District H in West Anchorage. Senate Bill 83 is brought forward by health care providers in my district who provide both in-person and telehealth services to Alaskans across the state. Senate Bill 83 will ensure pay parity for telehealth, requiring health care insurers to reimburse at the same payment rate for telehealth services as in-person care. Telehealth reduces barriers to care and allows patients to receive timely and convenient care from the comfort of their own homes. In Alaska, barriers to care affect individuals in rural areas, those with disabilities, and those with limited transportation options. Telehealth is especially important for chronic disease management, mental health services, and preventive care. The COVID-19 pandemic highlighted the critical need for telehealth access, particularly in a lot of the kinds of areas we talked about earlier, prompting the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services to temporarily implement telehealth parity. While this federal mandate has expired, some telehealth provisions remain in place. What was once a temporary need is now standard practice, and many states have made efforts to solidify and make permanent access to those services. In fact, over 33 states have enacted similar legislation to Senate Bill 83 to ensure fair reimbursement for telehealth services. Alaska's Medicaid program already has telehealth pay parity. This legislation builds upon that existing framework to require the same parity for private insurers. In our previous committee, we amended the legislation to remove the sunset language in Alaska's Medicaid telehealth statutes and telehealth statutes to ensure that it remains in law. Passage of this legislation will expand access to care, improve and maintain quality of care, and incentivize continued telehealth utilization. And now my staff, Serena Hackemiller, is available to present a sectional analysis of the bill.
Thank you very much, Senator Clayman.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, and members of the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee. For the record, my name is Serena Hackemiller, and I am staff to Senator Matt Clayman. This is a sectional analysis of the Senate Health and Social Services Committee Substitute Version O. Section 1 adds a new paragraph number 3 and references the definition of healthcare provider in AS 2107. Section 2 is the meat of the bill, establishing a new subsection C under Alaska Statute 2142-422, requiring health insurers to reimburse health care providers for telehealth services at the same rate as for in-person services. Amended into this section in the previous committee was the language, including behavioral health services, which has been our intent for the bill. Sections 3 through 6 conform existing statutes to Section 2. Section 3 adds a new paragraph 68 to the list of provisions which apply to home rule municipalities. Section 4 establishes a new section requiring a home rule or general law municipality offering a group health care insurance plan to meet the requirements of Section 2. It also provides a definition of health care insurance plan as given in 2152-500. Sections 5 and 6 amend statute to conform with Section 2, including the sections, the statutes for group insurance covering state employees and self-insured group health insurance plans covering active state employees. Sections 7 and 8 were amended in the last committee. This repeals the sunset language in session law pertaining to Medicaid health telehealth parity. Section 9 establishes an effective date of January 1st, 2026. This concludes the sectional analysis.
Thank you very much, Ms. Hackenmiller. Are there any questions for the bill sponsor or Ms. Hackenmiller? Seeing and hearing none, we'll go now to invited testimony. First up, joining us via the Teams Hub, is Jim Rivitzer.
Hello, can you see me and hear me?
We can, sir.
Excellent, thank you. I'm going to read a statement. My name is James Rivitzer, and I am the Peter and Deborah Wexler Professor of Economics, Management, and Public Policy at the Question School of Business at Boston University. I'm also a research associate at the National Bureau of Economic Research. My area of research and teaching is primarily in the area of health economics. In addition to teaching university classes in applied macroeconomics, behavioral economics, and health economics, I have published many academic papers about the economics of the U.S. healthcare system. I also recently published a book on innovation in healthcare that was published by Oxford University Press. It's called Why Not Better and Cheaper, Healthcare and Innovation. I'm here to testify about a new piece of legislation regarding the reimbursement for telehealth services. The bill requires a health insurer to reimburse for telehealth services on the same basis and at the same rate as comparable healthcare services provided in person. Let me begin with my conclusion. This is a reasonable piece of legislation worthy of your support. However, my reasoning may be of more interest to the committee than my conclusion. As an economist who studies management, I normally don't think that a state legislature should determine how much private insurers pay a contract to pay for services. As a rule, legislatures lack key information and incentives and move too slowly to set relative reimbursement rates. Better to leave that to negotiations between insurers and providers. However, telehealth may be the exception that proves the rule. Mandating equal payment can help solve a couple of economic problems that private parties can't solve on their own. Like every new treatment modality, telehealth requires providers to develop new capabilities to deliver distant care. Payers may be willing to pay something to induce providers to make these costly investments, but will they pay enough on their own? Maybe not. In our fragmented payment system, each provider treats patients from many different payers: Medicare, Medicaid, the state of Alaska, private insurers, private employers. And this diversity of payers creates the opportunity for what economists like to call free riding. Suppose a provider deals with 10 different payers, each paying $50 for a telehealth visit. Suppose providers are happy to invest adequately in telehealth capacity at that price. What would happen if one payer decided, I'm going to pay $40 for a telehealth visit? Providers might still be willing to deliver telehealth care to this payer because they've already borne the cost of developing the telehealth capacity. The insurer who pays $30 would, in effect, be free riding on the other payer's generosity. This would be annoying to the other payers. And if the rest followed suit, the result would be an inadequate investment in telehealth capacity, or in the extreme case, no investment at all. You can see what's going on here. The proposed bill can help with the free rider problem because it makes it harder for a single insurer or a single payer to free ride on investments in telehealth paid for by other payers. Some who object to payment parity might argue that the marginal cost of telehealth is less than in-person health. So parity in payments means you're overpaying for telehealth. And who wants to overpay, especially with budgets and tariffs and everything making money very tight? This reasoning makes sense until you think about it for a minute. Much of the cost of delivering telehealth is determined by what else providers could do with their time, how much money they could earn by delivering other health modalities. Payment parity has the advantage of not making it more expensive for providers who deliver telehealth services by forcing them to forego other more lucrative ways of delivering the care. Although I'm not an Alaskan, I am impressed by the vast distances healthcare providers must travel to reach all Alaskans. The cost of underinvestment in and underprovision of health telehealth is especially severe for Alaska. So the proposed legislation's value is likely to be especially high in Alaska. And that's the end of my testimony. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Revitzer. Are there any questions from committee members? Hearing and seeing none, thank you again for joining us today. Up next for invited testimony for this item is Dr. Sammy Mack. Dr. Mack, please state your name and affiliation for the record and begin your presentation. Dr. Mack is not with us. We will go next to Dr. Deltweiler. Mr. Deltweiler.
Yes, this is Dr. Detweiler, Howard Detweiler, MD. I am a practicing psychiatrist in Anchorage, and we see clients all over the state of Alaska, to include Barrow, way north, and here in Anchorage. Today would be an example. We had a snowstorm, and two of my clients were not able to come to the office as a result of the snowstorm. And the medical care that they needed, prescriptions, they needed to talk with me. I needed to discuss how these medications were working for them. The added cost to my office to provide these services is equal or even more than if I'm seeing a person here in my office as a result to the technological aid that I need to run these programs, and then the ongoing problems of failure of the system in the middle of asking important questions, which could add to the cost of needing an emergency consultation, say to a client's resident or place of employment. I was involved in helping the military to develop telecommunication in the Iraqi and Afghanistan war, which provided immediate care directly from healthcare providers to the combat zone. And it's become a very important asset, and would not be able to function here in Alaska without the use of telecommunications. Any questions?
Any questions from members of the committee? Mr. Detweiler, Dr. Detweiler, my apologies. I have a question. Could you walk the committee through how this piece of legislation would directly affect your practice? Just give us an example or two, if you could.
Well, we're doing healthcare where we see clients. Today, an example, two of the clients that had appointments in my office were not able to make it to my office as a result of the snowstorm that we had. Both of those clients needed medications that are restricted medications. I need to see them to justify the continuation of that medication. Need to evaluate side effects, benefits. And had they not been able to come to my office, I was not able to write those particular prescriptions. So it's very important to be able to continue continuity of care and telecommunication, especially here in Alaska, due to the distances and the climate and the problems that we have, are absolutely essential. And it is effective in enabling these clients to be able to come and be present by telecommunication versus a long drive in, and if there's a snowstorm or if someone is sick and they cannot come to the office, it continues the continuity of care.
Very well. Makes good sense. Any further questions from committee members?
Could you repeat that, please?
No, I'm just asking my fellow committee members if they had any further questions. We wish you all the best with the April snowstorm. Hopefully folks are safe. Very good. We'll move on to our next invited testifier if they are going to join us, and it doesn't look like they are. So maybe we'll have Dr. Mack on for our next hearing on this item. Senator Clayman or Ms. Hackemiller, do you have any closing remarks on Senate Bill 83 today?
Just thank you, Mr. Chair, for hearing the bill today. And if there are questions from the committee members, please contact our office.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much, Senator Clayman. We'll take a brief at ease while we set up for the next bill.
We're back on the record. It's 1:51 p.m. now. Next up, we have Senate Bill 21. This is our second hearing of this bill. During our first hearing, we adopted a CS version N, as in Nikiski, and heard a presentation of that bill. Today, it is my intention to have a recap of the bill, take invited and public testimony, and look to the will of the committee. With us for a brief recap, we have the bill sponsor, the Honorable Senator Bill Welikowski, and his staff, Maxine LaBerge. Welcome back to Senate Labor and Commerce. Please state your names for the record and begin your brief recap of the bill.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Bill Welikowski. I'm a state senator for East Anchorage, and Maxine LaBerge in my office is here with us today. Thank you for hearing this again. A brief recap. This is the Alaska Work and Save Bill. Over half of American households have no retirement savings. Over 20% of Alaska's population is retiring age or older, and this number grows every year. The Work and Save program establishes an auto IRA program for all Alaskan employees. 64% of Alaska small businesses do not offer retirement of any kind. Many would like to, however, it is actually very expensive and complicated to do so. In fact, polling shows that 70% of small businesses would support a savings plan if it were a reasonable option. This bill will create a system to provide such an option for small businesses. This is something that's been done in 17 other states. It provides small businesses with a mechanism for their employees to save for retirement. It allows for competition between big and small businesses for quality talent. We think it'll help the small business community. We think it'll help Alaskans, and we think it'll help us compete with other states in keeping Alaskans here. And it will help Alaskans to better prepare for their future and improve their quality of life. So I appreciate you hearing this bill. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Wilkowski. Any questions for the bill sponsor or staff? Seeing and hearing none, we will go now to invited testimony. First up is Ms. Marge Stoneking. Ms. Stoneking, welcome to Senate Labor and Commerce. You please state your name and affiliation for the record and begin your presentation.
Good afternoon, Chair Bjorkman, members of the committee. Thank you for taking up this important bill again so quickly. I am Marge Stoneking, AARP Alaska Advocacy Director. AARP is the largest nonprofit, nonpartisan membership organization in Alaska and in the country. Financial security is a key component of our advocacy agenda for Alaska 50 plus, and that begins with saving for retirement prior to being 50 and throughout one's working years. AARP's mission is to empower people to choose how they live as they age. And retirement readiness is a big part of having choices for how one lives in retirement. Social security is not enough to live on. Retirement readiness is good for Alaskans and also good for Alaska. The less retirement income you have, the more likely you are to have to rely on public programs like Medicaid, senior benefits, and SNAP to meet basic needs. And retirement readiness for the private sector requires a workplace savings option for all employees. The retirement crisis in this country is not a new challenge, but it's one that has persisted for several decades. Today, over half the nation's households are at risk of not having enough money to maintain their standard of living in retirement and being unable to afford necessities like food, utilities, and health care. Although some individuals are not saving enough, a vast number are not saving at all. 20% of adults age 30 and older have no retirement savings at all, and 14% have less than $10,000 saved for retirement. A critical reason for this shortage of savings is that a lack of access to workplace savings plans has remained low for decades. Roughly just half, as the bill sponsor mentioned, roughly half of private sector workers have access to a way to save from their regular paycheck at work, leaving nearly half without. Employers, particularly small business owners, often can't provide that retirement plan to their employees, again, due to their confusing, complicated, costly, and time-consuming nature. But without access to a retirement savings plan at work, nearly all workers fail to save. Turns out we're all human. AARP research has found that Americans are about 15 times more likely to save for retirement when they can do so at work. Work and Save is designed to address this retirement savings gap using tools such as payroll deduction and automatic enrollment that are proven to work. The Work and Save programs are changing the landscape on retirement readiness by giving businesses an easy, no-cost retirement program and giving workers a portable retirement savings program, allowing workers to build the savings they need to become retirement ready. And according to the National Institute on Retirement Security's research on Americans' views state-facilitated retirement program, the vast majority of Americans agree that state-facilitated privately managed retirement savings programs are a good idea. That support holds across party lines and across generations. This policy has consistent bipartisan support in polling among the public and among small business owners across the country and across time. And we know from our own in-state polling that across political ideology, Alaska small businesses also support a public-private retirement savings option. As the Senator mentioned, 7 in 10 Alaska small business owners support a privately managed, ready-to-go retirement savings option that would help small businesses offer employees a way to save for retirement. That's 71% of Republicans polled, 70% of Democrats, and 76% of independent business owners. Additionally, most small business owners agree that state legislators should support a bill to make it easier for small business owners to access a retirement savings option for their employees and themselves, such as SB 21 does. So AARP stands ready to work with the Alaska legislature to pass the Alaska Working Save so that generations of Alaskans can save and become retirement ready. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Stone King. Are there any questions from committee members? Hearing and seeing none, thank you, ma'am, for your presentation today. We'll go next to Ms. Anna Stevens. Ms. Stevens, please state your name and affiliation for the record and begin your presentation.
Hi, Anna Stevens from Colorado Secure Savings. I think Treasurer Young is actually here from Colorado to provide our testimony if you want to defer to him, but if not, I'm happy to provide it.
Most excellent. Thank you, ma'am. We'll go now to Dave Young, Colorado State Treasurer. Welcome to Senate Labor and Commerce. Please state your name and affiliation for the record and begin your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Dave Young. I'm the Colorado State Treasurer, and I am the chair of the board for the Colorado Secure Savings Program. I appreciate the opportunity to make remarks to the board. Mr. Chair, if I may ask, just sliding in here, I want to be sure that I honor your time. How much time do I have to speak?
Well, we have an hour left in this hearing, sir.
Well, you better give me a time limit. I'm pretty passionate about this program, so feel free to cut me off if I've gone overboard. But I'm here to really encourage your support of the bill and specifically to talk about one section of the bill, which is on page 7, line 14, which allows through the legislation to enter an agreement with other states to provide services related to retirement savings programs similar to the one that you're trying to start here. So Colorado Secure Savings Program is a state-facilitated auto IRA program. We launched the program through legislation. The legislation was passed in 2020, but we launched officially in 2023. And we have established what is known as the Partnership for a Dignified Retirement to help other states that want to get a fast start or maybe actually are too small to launch independently an opportunity to partner with us so that they can leverage the procurement work and the other work that we've done and maybe fast track the work that they do through the partnership. And so we have established the Partnership for Dignified Retirement. It is an option for you, and I will tell you that we have some other states. We have three other states that have actually partnered with us. We have a fourth that is in the final stages of coming on board as a partner state. And so we have we're the first program in the state to offer a partnership. And we have a track record now of showing that that is helpful for these small, sometimes small states that are struggling to launch, they're able to leverage the procurement we have done. As was remarked earlier, it's a public-private partnership, and so in Colorado, we've gone through a complete procurement process, a competitive process to bring on fund managers and a program manager, along with other consultants, in order to help us guide the work that we do. And so the partner states that we have are leveraging that by using the same program administrator, Vestwell, and our fund managers. What's the advantage to Colorado? Well, when we did the procurement for our fund managers, when we wrote the contracts through the procurement process with them, we actually wrote in price breaks for fees for savers. The more assets under management, and when we hit those price breaks, the fees come down. So they make it very reasonable for your Alaska savers. And it also helps our savers because the fees come down to them as well. So it's, you know, a very collaborative and a productive partnership that we propose. We are very proud of the work that we're doing. We have about 75,000 funded accounts now. We just went well past 100 million in assets here in Colorado. And some of our partner states are beginning to take off as well. And we have numbers on that as well. I don't want to get too deep into the numbers, but we are turning the corner for retirement savings in the state of Colorado. And I might mention that we've also seen a substantial uptick in private plan adoption because, as you have, we wrote the bill to say that a business must do something, but they don't necessarily have to use our program. And some businesses are opting to select a private sector plan as well. And so we're not in competition with the private sector. My goal is more savers. And so however we can get people to save, whether it's through the plan that we offer through the Treasury here in Colorado or through a private sector plan, as long as people begin to save and continue to save regularly, that's the goal. And this is the shared goal that we have with our partner states as well. So I'm going to stop there and ensure that if there are questions, I can answer them. I don't want to go on and on. I'm very passionate about the program. So if you let me keep talking, I'll use up your whole hour.
Thank you very much, Mr. Young. I appreciate that. Are there any questions from committee members? I have a question, Mr. Young. For folks in Colorado, how is the usage rate with folks kind of leaving their money in their IRA accounts and allowing that money to mature and grow over a long period of time? Are people doing that, or do you find that it's more of a short-term thing where people are needing to withdraw their money early? How's that working out?
Thank you for the question, Mr. Chair. We actually launched in 2023, so I'm not sure we really have data that would give you a really solid glimpse into that. What we've discovered, however, is our average funded account balance continues to grow. So this tells us as time goes on, that people are remaining with the program, they're not pulling their money out. It is a Roth IRA. There are some penalties that occur if you're under 59 and you haven't allowed the money to stay in place, for I think it's 5 years. But we're seeing people actually take advantage of the automatic adjustment in rate. So there's an escalator in law, and every year the escalator goes up 1%. Starts at 5 and goes up. The good news is that the savers themselves control that. If they don't want to go with the default contribution rate of 5%, they can adjust that up and down. If they don't want to go with the automatic increase each year, they can adjust that. Some actually escalate up because they have capacity in their payroll check. But it's really under the control of the saver to control how this works for them financially. But we do have people who do opt out. They don't want to participate, so it is a voluntary program for people here in the state of Colorado, as it is for our partner states. If they get enrolled and they decide they don't want to do it, they certainly can. We have the option for people to suspend if they want to and then start again. I mean, again, the SABR has complete control over that. But like I said, our average balance has been increasing over the 2 years we've been actually in operation getting funded accounts, and that tells us that people are leaving that money in and letting it work.
Very good. And what is the opt-out rate there in Colorado?
I'm going to wait a second and see if I can get that data. I'm getting text messages back and forth with my staff, so we'll see if we can get an accurate number for you.
The other question I have is, what has the reception been like for this program from employers, and how much time do they spend administering this program as they're doing payroll?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll address your first request about the opt-out. As you know, with all retirement programs, you know, a potential saver has to go through a process called KYC, that's Know Your Customer. And so of the people that actually clear that process, about 20% opt out in Colorado. So that's as good a number as I can give you. On the business side, I've actually done several trips around the state. And just like Alaska, which I visited some years ago, beautiful state, we have a beautiful state as well, so it's not a real sacrifice to travel around the state. And when I do, I visit with businesses that are using the program, and I've actually been online and watched businesses register their business and their employees into the program. And my experience is, it's very easy to enroll in the program. I've watched the business enroll and get all their employees in about 15 minutes. We did this purposely because we heard from employers that they wanted the easy button. They didn't want to have it be difficult, so we worked very hard to make sure that it's easy to register and to maintain. And, you know, when I visit these businesses, they're pleased that that they have an option. Particularly the smaller businesses that can provide a part of a compensation package to keep their employees engaged and on the payroll. And when I talk to the employees, some of them are ecstatic because they've never been able to save before. Others maybe didn't even know they were starting to save until it's pointed out to them. And when it's pointed out to them that they are saving, many of them say, I never thought I was going to be able to save. And he's made it so easy for me, and we're really excited about that. I'm not going to say that everybody is ecstatic about it. We have some that are, you know, businesses that are so busy that, and you know this very well, it's everything a small business owner can do to just get the work done for the day. And so we work with them as well and try to make sure that it's easy for them to enroll so it's not a burden on them. And I think that's the experience that we've seen in our partner state as well.
Very well. Thank you. Any additional questions for Mr. Young? Senator Yunt has a question.
Thank you, through the chair. Just a couple quick ones here. So you said earlier this was similar to or maybe is a Roth IRA model, so I assume this is contributions would be on a pre-tax basis?
Mr. Chair and Senator, this is post-tax. It's a Roth IRA.
Okay. Follow-up?
Indeed.
Would the plan offer different risk levels, say like a low-risk model, medium, high-risk, so that the person that's investing in it could choose different, you know, different vehicles for their, depending on what stage of life they're in?
Mr. Chair and Senator, great question. We actually did a lot of research on this. We did some studies before we actually ran the legislation. What we discovered is that the more complexity that you offer savers, sometimes the more reluctant they are to actually make a decision. And we wondered why people weren't saving, and a big piece of this was they just didn't understand the landscape, they didn't understand the acronyms, and they just didn't really understand how it all worked. And so we've tried to make sure that we have a default target date fund set up for people who just want to save the money but want to take advantage of the overall long-term growth of the markets. We have diversified our lineup a little bit as we've added some options for savers, but we only have done that from the standpoint of making sure that these are options that our savers want. Nothing worse than to, you know, spend a lot of time coming up with options for investments that nobody wants. So this is where the feedback that we get from our savers, not only in the state of Colorado, but across our partner states, helps guide us and collectively in the kinds of diversification that we offer.
Senator Yount.
Thank you for that. That was a great explanation. Next question, is there an employer match option where the employer can put some in along with if they chose?
Mr. Chair, I will say that this is a Roth IRA, so under ERISA, a match is not allowed. I will tell you that we are working with our congressional partners on what's called the Savers Match. There seems to be some conflicts in the Secure 2.0 legislation that was recently passed by Congress that we would like to open up to maybe fix that piece of it so that, you know, that this would open up that. But, you know, a lot of our businesses kind of like the fact that it's a Roth IRA. They're not the fiduciary. They don't have to hire lawyers and accountants to figure all this out. Our boards in each state are the fiduciary, and so we do that work for them. They kind of like it. They're really a tight budget. There's not an obligation on their business to actually match, because they may not have capacity as a small business to do that. I think is yet to be seen as we go through more versions of the Secure Act, maybe heading to 3.0 at some point, what options we want to provide for people. And like I said, I think there have been some businesses that have said, you know, what we want to do is we want to offer a different kind of plan for our employees, maybe a 401k that does allow a match. And if we want to do that, then now this has been the incentive to offer that. So the fact that they have to do something, either go with our Secure Savings Program or with a private sector plan, has kind of prompted them to move forward. So if they do want to offer a match, they certainly have a pathway to do that. And our private sector financial services businesses in the state of Colorado have been busy. They've been actually having a lot of business come their way strictly due to that. Just back to what our diversified lineup is in the offerings to our savings. We have capital preservation, we have fixed income, domestic equity, and international equity in addition to the target date funds.
Last question. Thank you very much. How has your guys' fund compared so far, say, compared to the S&P 500 since inception?
Sorry, could you repeat the question? Didn't quite hear it.
Since you guys created the fund, how is your guys' performance compared to, say, the Dow Jones or the S&P 500, the performance of the fund?
Well, I think we're – going to talk about long-term, not the recent volatility of the market, unless you want me to remark on that. We have structured this with our partners to ensure that we have, you know, long-term sustainable performance. We are benchmarked to those indices, but we do have benchmarks that we work with our investment consultants to set, and that's what our fund managers manage to with their offices.
Thank you.
And I, if I may, I just with Mark, and I have been on actually with the media here in Colorado quite a bit over the past several days, and particularly people are concerned, and I think the message that I've been trying to tell people is that whether it's the public retirement system that we have here in Colorado or Colorado Secure Savings or other long-term savings, is that we're not day traders. We don't try to invest in the short term. We actually look to the long term and diversify portfolios to mitigate the risk that we see. We want good risk adjusted returns over the long term for people. And this is how you build a sustainable portfolio for people that they can rely upon once they reach retirement.
Thank you very much, Mr. Young. Any further questions? Seeing and hearing none, thank you again for joining us today. At this time, I will open public testimony on Senate Bill 21. Is there anyone in the room who wishes to testify to this item? Please come forward. Welcome.
Thank you, Chairman and committee members. My name is Jane Andreen. I live in Douglas, Alaska, and I'm here to wholeheartedly support this bill. It wasn't until I was in my late 30s and I came to work for the state that I was even able to begin thinking about retirement planning. I had worked for small businesses and nonprofits up until that time. One experience that's kind of sort of like this is when I was the director of the domestic violence program in Homer back in the 80s and early 90s. We had an option for our employees to join a credit union and have a portion of their salary deposited into a savings account. It was not investment, it was savings. And our salaries were low enough that what people were able to afford to put in was $5 or $10 or $15 or $20 a pay period. But it was something that people really appreciated and was part of the small benefits package we were able to offer them. I think it's really important as we look at the growing silver tsunami, or as I like to reference it, the platinum blonde, that we look at what options we can provide. Having a secure retirement is something that is so critical. My grandparents had 13 children, 12 of which lived to adulthood. My grandfather farmed. He hung wallpaper. He had a store for a short time, but his partner absconded with the funds. And I asked my dad not long before he died, I said, you know, did Grandpa have to declare bankruptcy? He said, no, Jane. He worked until he paid that all back. The last 20 years of my grandmother's life, she lived on Social Security. She knew how to do it because she had lived poor her whole life. But we need to make sure that people here in this day and age have some options to help them move forward to retirement age. Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am. Anyone else in the room wishing to testify to Senate Bill 21? Seeing no one, we'll go online. Is there anyone online to testify to this item? Seeing no one, we'll close public testimony. Senate Bill 21 is now back before the committee. Is there any committee discussion? What are the wishes of the committee?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move to report committee substitute for Senate Bill 21, version 34-LS0254/November from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Is there any objection? Seeing and hearing none, committee substitute for Senate Bill 21, version 34-LS0254 /N as in Nikolaevsk, is reported from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes. Please stay after we adjourn to sign the committee report. The Senate Labor and Commerce Committee will meet again on Wednesday, April 9th, when we will hear Senate Bill 4, health care prices and incentive programs. As there is no further business to come before Senate Labor and Commerce at this time, we are adjourned at 2:23 p.m.